5 years ago, I learned about inversion, and it's so valuable. You know, everybody knows what they hate, right? They know what their nightmare day looks like. They know what they don't enjoy doing. But people are really bad about predicting what they love or what they will love when it happens. And so Chris and I, 5 years ago, we literally sat down and we said, what does our worst possible day look like? What are all the things we dread? And it was being stuck in meetings all day, traveling, being away from our families, not having time with our kids, not sleeping well, you know, all these things. We made a big list and we basically set up anti-goals for ourselves. And that has just been so incredibly instructive in making our lives better. And I think it's aspirational. You know, we're still too busy. We still have busy calendars and stuff, but we at least know what our anti-goals are and what we're trying to avoid. There's that great quote that Munger always likes to share, show me where I'm going to die so I don't go there. And I think rubbing your nose in all the things that can go wrong is a really worthwhile exercise and can save you a lot of strife.
Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. Today's episode is with Andrew Wilkinson. He's a co-founder of a company called Tiny. They own more than 30 different companies, including Dribbble, MetaLab, Girlboss, and Castro. Collectively, these businesses are bringing in more than $100 million in annual revenue. And this was a really unique conversation because Andrew had just taken WeCommerce public the week of this interview. Since then, their market cap has been hovering at around $700 million. To $1 billion Canadian dollars. He's become one of the leading names in the world of buying, starting, and growing online businesses, and I'm so excited to bring this conversation to you. Listen in to hear us discuss why Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger's approach inspired Andrew to create the Berkshire Hathaway of the internet, how mental models like inversion can help you think more effectively, the four types of entrepreneurs and understanding which type you are, how to hire key employees and a CEO to replace you, the importance of incentives and how to align employees around a shared vision. And as always, you can watch this visually on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. I have timestamps on both the audio and the video, so if you need to switch between or skip ahead, you can do that. Let us know your favorite parts and what you thought on Twitter. I'm at bzaidi, b-z-a-i-d-i, and he's A Wilkinson. Now let's get straight into the show. Cool. Well, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
It's been a crazy week for you, man. You just took a company public. What's been going on in your world?
Yeah, I mean, we started a business about 10 years ago in the Shopify ecosystem. We were one of Shopify's first partners in their themes and apps ecosystems. And so about 10 years ago, we started a business, you know, thinking, hey, this might make us a couple thousand bucks a month and fun little side business. And we just took it public. Along with some other businesses we acquired on Monday, and we just cracked $1 billion market cap, which is pretty wild. So it's been a cool week.
That's crazy, man. Yeah, I know you've been back to back with Yahoo Finance and Bloomberg, and we had to fit in a Creator Lab episode. So I appreciate you taking the time, man. So, so look, for people that don't know your background, people are starting to call you the Warren Buffett of the internet. And I don't know if that's a label you like or dislike, but we'll get into kind of why that's going on right now. And I first heard of you like a few years ago now, and I just saw that you were going and buying companies, and it was an approach that many people were just kind of ignoring, but it looked like low-hanging fruit that people should be at least exploring. So could you just give the listeners an understanding of what you've been doing with Tiny over the last few years?
Sure. So I started a design agency called MetaLab about 15 years ago. And my original goal was to run my own business, make enough money to pay my rent, work with some friends. And actually, in the beginning, I was thinking I would just do it for a little bit, and then I'd go get a job in Silicon Valley. And I just kind of overshot. I ended up getting a lot of really great startup clients. And over time, I ended up landing Walmart, Apple, Facebook, Google, all sorts of big companies as our clients. And because of that, you know, suddenly we had a profitable business. And I didn't really understand investing or stocks or anything like that. And so I took the money that we made running the agency, and I used it to start more businesses. So I started a couple of SaaS software companies. I started the Shopify business that I mentioned before. And some of those were failures. Some of them went really well. But by about 2013, I was running five companies and I just hated my life. You know, we're doing really well. The businesses were all growing and we're making money, but I was just not happy. And I poured my heart out to a friend and he said, look, you know, you need to read about Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett owns 100 companies, but he hires CEOs to run all of them. And I went, well, that's kind of interesting. And so I picked up a book about Buffett and it just kind of blew my mind. I never realized that you could delegate, you know, running a company to a CEO. That just hadn't crossed my mind. And so after reading Buffett, I ended up spinning out all of our businesses, hiring CEOs, and I kind of built my own mini Berkshire Hathaway, which we call Tiny, with my business partner, Chris. And for the last 7 years or so, we've been buying wonderful internet businesses, usually from founders who are bootstrapped and they just want a simple deal with somebody who will respect their culture, leave their team alone, and let their business keep doing its thing. And so we've been doing that for quite a while now, and it's working out really well. We've got, I think, over 30 businesses now. I the coolest part is I get to do it all from Victoria, Canada. So, you know, I get to live in the middle of nowhere and run this global business. It's really cool.
You mentioned $1 billion valuation just earlier. But is there any sense of scale you can give of the 30 companies that you mentioned? Because my understanding is not all of those are part of WeCommerce.
Yeah, WeCommerce is just one of many businesses in the group of companies. We're a private business, so we don't have a valuation, right? We don't really think about that. We just think about growing earnings over time.
For the sake of focus today, what we're really going to focus on is this process. So I heard you mention studying Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, and so much so that you've got like these little statues in your office, it looks like. Just to summarize what they do really is they buy, they hire and incentivize, and they kind of take a step back and they let the CEOs run the businesses the same way you are. And I think that sounds super simple, but doing it in practice, I think, is incredibly difficult, as you obviously know. And I wanted to hone into some of those pieces today. So why don't we just kick off with mental models that you've been looking at? So you mentioned studying Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger before. Like, what were some of the first ones that you started to say, okay, if we're going to go down this process and we're going to be able to delegate, like, what are the sorts of things that you started to think about to make that effective?
There's all sorts of stuff that Munger and Buffett do that we've learned from. I mean, my entrepreneurial journey has been me just repeatedly realizing my own limitations and then hiring other people to help me achieve things that I otherwise wouldn't be able to do by myself. So, you know, when I started my company, I was a designer. And I felt guilty when I started delegating out the design work in the agency. And it was really hard for me to let go of that. And then, you know, it was the sales and marketing and all the other pieces. And over time, you realize that your job as an entrepreneur or as a CEO is really to delegate out everything and to build systems. And I think Buffett and Munger are just the purest distillation of that. They've basically gotten to a point where they can buy a $25 billion business. And at the end of the day, it's a lot of analysis of the business and what could go wrong and structuring the deal. But from there, it's really making sure that they have smart, ethical, and well-incentivized management in place and to leave them to it. And I mean, it's very interesting. Their approach is really just to almost manage by neglect, to choose smart people, and fully say, you know, we'll talk to you if you need anything, but otherwise we don't expect to hear from you, and just monitor the results. And I think for most entrepreneurs, that's really hard to do. I've always been a little, I have a funny personality. I get very excited about something for a month or two, and then I immediately like to move on to the next thing. And so what used to happen is I'd start a business or I'd be the CEO, and then I'd get distracted with something new, and I would let down that existing business. And when I realized I could hire a CEO to follow through, I started doing so much better. And I stopped beating myself up. I realized that's just my specific personality, and that there's people who love to run businesses and do the follow through side. So it's a win-win. You know, if you can hire someone great and give them an amazing job that they're happy with, and at the same time you're not doing a role you're not very good at, I think that's a great thing.
One of the things that I've looked at with Munger in particular is this kind of concept of inversion, and kind of a lot of the times you'll say, what does a good business look like? What does a good marriage look like? And inversion, my understanding of it, is taking the opposite view and saying, what does a bad marriage look like? What does a bad life look like? Is that still how you try to think about big questions like this?
Yeah, about 5 years ago, I learned about inversion, and it's so valuable. You know, everybody knows what they hate, right? They know what their nightmare day looks like. They know what they don't enjoy doing. But people are really bad about predicting what they love or what they will love when it happens. And so Chris and I, 5 years ago, we literally sat down and we said, what does our worst possible day look like? What are all the things we dread? And it was being stuck in meetings all day, traveling, being away from our families, not having time with our kids, not sleeping well, you know, all these things. We made a big list and we basically set up anti-goals for ourselves. And that has just been so incredibly instructive in making our lives better. And I think it's aspirational. You know, we're still too busy. We still have busy calendars and stuff, but we at least know what our anti-goals are and what we're trying to avoid. There's that great quote that Munger always likes to share, show me where I'm going to die so I don't go there. And I think rubbing your nose in all the things that can go wrong is a really worthwhile exercise and can save you a lot of strife.
I think that's the macro of the macro, looking down at your whole life, whether that's business or your family or kids, but just honing into the business part specifically. So you mentioned like not wanting to be in meetings all day, not having stress of clients, that sort of stuff, which you might have had previously. Were there other things specifically that you really had to hone in on and say, okay, if we're going to grow to 30 or one day 100 companies, we really need to make sure we're not doing any of these things?
I mean, I think the biggest thing is just trying to only make a few good decisions a year. We've had years where we almost do no deals, and we don't really do, we're always making moves, but our goal is really to only make a decision every 2 or 3 months that really moves the needle. And I think when you're an entrepreneur, you get addicted to decision-making, and one of the most exciting parts about it is you wake up in the morning and you've got 20 texts from your team and everyone's asking you questions and you've got emails and they're all interesting problems. But what ends up happening is you get decision fatigued and you make worse and worse decisions. And so our goal always is to try and limit the number of things that actually make their way to us, so that, you know, we're only having to make a few decisions, you know, ideally around incentives, M&A, and capital allocation, and not getting into the weeds on all the other stuff. And, you know, we're not always there. There's periods right now I'm getting, you know, lit up every single morning with questions and stuff. But our best times where we make the best decisions are usually very quiet, or us sitting on our hands and saying no to a lot of stuff for a very long time. I mean, Munger talks about reading Barron's every week for 70 years and then finally buying one stock and doing really, really well on that stock. I think that's a really interesting way to look at life.
Yeah, I've also heard you mention your approach as like you talk about New Zealand as a country that people don't always think about, but they're quietly plugging away and they've got a great economy. I don't know the specifics of this, but they don't have nuclear war. they're kind of peaceful. They've got a beautiful country. Could you just share a little bit about what you mean by New Zealand? Because I think you mentioned being in Canada, it's not in Silicon Valley, even though you spent time there. So what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, I find this pretty funny. So, you know, if you think about New Zealand, there's a lot of interesting things about it. I mean, one is that it's food and energy independent. So it's self-sufficient. And so when I think about that through the lens of a business, it's not reliant on paid customer acquisition. There's no middleman. There's no platform sitting between you and your customers. It has a stable democracy. So in business, I'd say that's, you know, a loyal and engaged user or customer base or network of people using the product. It's in the middle of nowhere. So your competitors forget about you, and it's very hard to invade. Nobody's going to come and try and invade New Zealand. It's really inconvenient to invade. And so we think about that as a competitive moat. But yeah, that's kind of something that we like to, it's a simple way to put our investment approach.
And it kind of comes to this concept of like fishing where the fish are. I know that's something Munger talks about. I've heard you mention it as well. Could you go into a little bit more detail around how you guys think about where to be playing? Because you've bought SaaS companies primarily. I think a lot of them are connected to the Shopify ecosystem, but you've also got some agency businesses still. You bought Girlboss, which is obviously a media brand nowadays. And you've got Dribbble, a huge community for creative people. So I've heard you describe like not trying to come up with a cohesive strategy where everything works together. It's more about just finding the best businesses that work really well. And like, how have you thought about that as it relates to kind of fishing where the fish are?
I think the idea behind that is that if you go to a fishing hole, if you go to a big fishing hole with a few big fish, like, and you know, thousands of competitive fishermen all trying to catch those fish, you're not very likely to have success. So while the opportunity might be massive to get this huge big game fish, to anything that's hyper competitive, very VC funded, lots of people all trying to get rich doing that one thing, I always like to say we try to find sleepy fishing holes that are off the beaten path with a few fishermen who are casually doing it as a hobby. We don't want to be investing in a business where there's millions of dollars of VC money flowing in every minute and there's constant competition. We like businesses with small total addressable markets that are just healthily growing at 20 or 30% a year that aren't necessarily going to be a billion-dollar business or aren't in a sexy space. And we own some sexy businesses, some really, really cool ones, but we also own some kind of sleepy, boring ones. And you know, I'd rather buy the auto dealerships and the dry cleaners of the internet than the super flashy, hyper innovative, you know, Teslas and stuff.
And again, is that really just because there's less people competing in that space, or is it just you're attracted to that sort of stuff inherently?
I just like simple businesses. I mean, I've always run businesses that are profitable and sustainable. They're serving a customer who's happy with the product and they have happy employees and happy customers. But we don't need to go out and say that unless this is a billion-dollar business, it's meaningless. And I love that. So for me, what I'm looking for from a business is something that's just doing something good in the world. And can continue to grow over the long term that we feel good about and where we like the management team.
This week you announced going public, but it's not just, you know, like what people hear when they hear going public. They think of like Facebook going public and everyone's trying to buy the stock right in the beginning.
What we did is we did a reverse takeover. So it's kind of similar to a SPAC. A SPAC is where investors go out, they raise $500 million, and then they basically merge in another business, and then the SPAC and their investors own a percentage. That's not exactly what we did. What we did is we found a shell corporation in Canada, which had a small amount of money in it, and we merged into that, which is much more common in Canada. So it's less dilutionary. And it's not like I think people think we went out and we weren't raised a SPAC. We just merged into a shell company to go public.
To go into that a little bit more. So previously you were originally self-funded, and then it sounds like you partnered with some high-profile people and people who brought in some money as LPs or whatever. I've heard you say before that specifically with Dribbble, you said if you had $50 million, you wouldn't really change like anything that you're doing with Dribbble because you've already got an audience, it's already working great. What changed that you said, okay, I want to go down this route? And what opportunities do you see now that you wouldn't have been able to attack previously?
Yeah, so what happened was I sold the Shopify business in 2013. I was too overwhelmed, and so I sold it, and then I kept about 20% of it myself and stayed on the board. So I was still kind of involved. And after that, I started reading about investing. And when I read about investing and about Buffett, I realized that it was actually a really exceptional business and I probably shouldn't have sold it. And then I watched as Shopify took off like a rocket. and just kept growing and growing and growing. And so while I had sold it for, a good multiple of earnings at the time, I hadn't anticipated how big Shopify could get. And as I studied the Shopify ecosystem and the story and the growth, I realized a couple of things. One was that e-commerce was set to double by 2024. And that I thought I was just very bullish. I thought e-commerce was going to grow a lot over the next decade or two. And I knew that Shopify was really the only alternative to Amazon. If you're an independent retailer, Shopify is by far the best platform to sell on, specifically because they won't compete with you and they have massive scale. So they're now, I think, 5.9% of all e-commerce sales. So it's becoming very significant. And if you look at Salesforce or the iPhone, as those platforms grow, there's often partners who do very well. So on the iPhone, all the app developers in Salesforce, all the partners in the App Exchange ecosystem. And so, we basically thought, hey, let's make a bet on this. Let's go buy back the business that we sold. And then we'll also raise some additional cash, both from Tiny, as well as some friends of ours who are big name investors. And we started a company called WeCommerce, which is a holding company. And we raised the money to acquire more great businesses in the ecosystem. We went and made a few acquisitions. And then we really decided that this is such a big opportunity that, A, we think public market investors would be excited about the opportunity to invest in the Shopify ecosystem. And no one had really provided that opportunity other than just buying Shopify stock. And two, that additional access to capital would help us accelerate that vision and allow us to make a lot more acquisitions. So we went out and we raised $60 million, which just went live on Monday. And now we're just sitting with our elephant gun waiting for the next acquisition.
You know, that three-part process, which is buy, hire, incentivize. So it's still within the buy part of this process. It sounds like you're looking at 700, 1,000 companies a year, and you might only buy a handful, like three or five, I heard you say. So a big part of that is obviously being patient. And one of the biggest parts of being patient is to be able to keep your emotions under control, right? And not get overhyped by something that looks like a shiny object, and really staying strict with your thesis or whatever you've set out to find. Are there things that you've been able to do over time to get better at that? Or is that something you think you're naturally already kind of well suited towards?
Well, I think I used to be somebody, I was a gadfly, right? So someone would say, hey, we should start a startup doing X or Y or Z. And because I was excitable and optimistic, I could see the vision and get excited about it. And then, I started learning a lot of different businesses. I've started probably 15 or 20 businesses over the years. And, a handful of those have been really successful, but a lot of them have failed and been really great lessons. Everything from an e-commerce cat furniture store to a pizza place that me and my friend owned for a while. And it's just, those have all been great lessons. And so now I feel like I have enough business experience that when an opportunity surfaces, I can usually identify all the pitfalls and can invert and go, okay, well, I can see the upside, but what's the downside? What's our plan if, X and Y and Z don't come through and then the market does poorly or whatever? And so that's usually what we're handicapping when we're looking at an acquisition is how can we structure it so that if we lose, we're not losing a lot.
Yeah, and that's very different to like venture capital where they might only make money on one deal out of 100 or one out of 10 and nine of them are going to lose a lot of money, right? So it sounds like you guys have existing businesses. You can see the money coming in. You can see the cash flow and the assets. So even if it doesn't go to plan, it might go down by 30 to 50% or something like that. But going to zero sounds like it's not really going to happen. In fact, has that ever happened to you?
It's happened one time. It happened one time where we got defrauded. And it was a very small acquisition through. We did it with a friend of ours. And that was a really great learning experience too. And I'm glad it happened with a small amount of money, not a large amount. But other than that, no, we've never lost significant amount of money on an investment. I would say that we generally expect to do well in like 90% of circumstances, given the way we structure things. But you know, now and then it's unavoidable. We're definitely going to have some screw ups over the years.
Are there some other examples of acquisitions that didn't go as well, and you've taken some learnings from it? And I'm curious, like, what those learnings were that you avoided the next time around.
I would say not so much that things have gone wrong, but where we've realized that there's much greater opportunity in buying very, very high quality businesses that can exist for 10 or 20 years versus what we used to get excited about, which is what Warren Buffett calls cigar butts. You know, you find a musty old cigar butt on the ground and you get a free puff. Businesses that might go out of business in 5 years, but you can probably make your money back plus some. They're very stressful and difficult to navigate, and they're shrinking. So they're negative in that you can't really give employees great opportunities because they're not growing. There's not upward momentum, et cetera. So we always prefer to buy exceptional businesses like Dribbble, for example, where we can look at it and go, this is going to exist in, you know, 10 or 20 years.
I'm curious, like, this year that we've all gone through, and for context, we're recording this, you know, towards the end of December 2020. So on a positive side for you guys as a business is that e-commerce has become more prominent. And I heard the Shopify founder say in a recent interview that what they thought was going to take until 2030 is already happening. And you mentioned the doubling of growth in a couple of years as well. So we're at about 25% penetration for e-commerce sales right now from the last numbers I looked at. So that might be a positive thing that's happened, but there's also a lot of uncertainty and kind of like headwinds as well. So I'm curious, like, has your strategy changed because of the what's happened this year?
No, not really. It's been a reminder that anything can happen, but most of the businesses that we own, we're already participating in the knowledge economy and internet focused. So it doesn't really change anything for us because of this sort of investing we do. We're always investing in the new economy, not the old economy.
Yeah, I guess maybe the pizza shop, if you still had that, might be affected. And what about the services side? Because that's an interesting one, given it was your original kind of start a business that got you your original nest egg, I guess. Most people in the tech world see service businesses as bad businesses, and I've even heard you describe them generally as bad businesses. But because of your arbitrage with the Canadian costs of like employment and stuff like that, it ends up being an okay business. I'm curious, like, why you've still kept those service businesses rather than just selling them and moving on to like SaaS and other things that seem to have better margins.
Well, that's where we started. And I always underestimated those businesses. And I would say, you know, in the early days, that was the advantage. Being in Canada, we could afford to pay people, you know, good salaries for here, but still make enough arbitrage to make a good profit. Now we're actually a fully remote business. So the team is located all over the world. That, you know, I would say we have high margins because we have a great reputation. For 15 years, the team has consistently done incredible work and helped build, you know, now many multi-billion dollar businesses and help launch them and stuff. So I would say the downside to a services business is that it's linear. You can only hire so many great people a year. You can only scale your culture linearly, and you can only sell your time at the end of the day. So it's a limited amount of throughput. And that's probably what I don't like about services businesses. With Dribbble, with the same team size, the revenue could 6x, right? If you pulled the right levers or you built the right digital products or, you know, subscription systems or whatever. So I think from an efficiency standpoint, services businesses are just harder to scale. They can be amazing businesses, and we own amazing services businesses. And we haven't sold them because, A, it's our baby. That was the original business. That's the goose that laid the golden egg. We still love owning that business. We love working with the team there. And we love the products that they're able to help build. It just hasn't made sense or been something we've wanted to really do. Selling it. We've had offers over the years, but it's never been something we've felt we wanted to pursue. We really felt that we could redeploy the profits, you know, and keep diversifying. And we're very happy to do that. We don't like selling businesses in general, right? That's not really a strategy we think about. We think about how do we pay ourselves back with profits every time we buy a business.
I guess that brings up, it kind of leads us into the hiring part. But before we even get into your processes for hiring and what makes good employees and good CEOs, I'm curious if you see those agencies as like central resources as well that can then go and service some of your other portfolio companies, or they're just completely separate.
So we say no synergy, right? We think that we've been tempted by this before, where we say, hey, this business we own needs to build an app. We should use MetaLab to do that or whatever. And what we end up finding is that the CEO of this company wants a discount because they're part of the family, or they feel annoyed because they wanted to use a different company, but we pressured them to use MetaLab or Z1 or one of our agencies. So what we've instead done is said, all the CEOs are free to work with each other or not. And we don't mandate that. We don't pressure them at all. And we fully let them make that decision on their own. There have been businesses that we have started because of the needs we've had. So for example, in the early days, we used to negotiate everything, and we stopped doing that over time because we got too big. And you know, the employees, nobody wants to have an uncomfortable negotiation. They'd rather focus on making more money and growing the business. And so we met this guy who loved to negotiate, and we said, hey, look, all of our companies need this service. You know, they all use SaaS products. They all have office leases. They all buy a lot of furniture, you know, whatever it is. Can you basically start an agency that is negotiation as a service? So we started this company, Buyer, and Buyer basically goes out and will audit all the products you use and try and save you a bunch of money. And we said to them, look, you can go and email all our companies, or we'll intro you, but we're never going to mandate it. And if you can get paid more working with other companies, you don't have to work with our companies at all. So that's how we operate. We just are totally decentralized. There's no synergy. There's no forcing anyone to work together.
That's really interesting. Yeah, because I guess you could make an argument either way, but I like that this seems consistent with your approach, which is you need to give the right incentives for the CEOs to feel ownership. And if you were there mandating, saying, hey, use this service, use that service, that would not be what they've signed up for.
We've had, to take it a level further, I mean, I've had CEOs come to me and say, I'm going to go and spend $1 million on this project that I think can result in a lot of future revenue. And I'll say to them, I totally disagree. And I think this is a boondoggle and this is the wrong approach, but you're the CEO, go and do it and see. You know my opinion, right? So I would never, unless it was like a really fatal error, I'm not going to say, no, you can't do that or hold them back. I'm just going to say, hey, I have reservations. And I've been proven wrong. There's times where the CEOs were totally right and I was out of line. And then there's other times where I've been proven right. So even on that level, we really let the CEOs do whatever they want. And I think that gives them a sense of freedom they can't get anywhere else. There's very few places where they can work where they aren't going to have a board of directors breathing down their neck, or public shareholders, or a private equity firm that wants to sell the business in 2 years or whatever it is.
Yeah, for sure. I forgot the exact phrase that Jeff Bezos uses, but it sounds like something I've heard him talk about this too, which is when he doesn't agree with something, he kind of registers like that he doesn't agree, but then he has to like say, okay, you're in charge of that. But it's kind of on the record that you've shared your opinion at least.
That's where I got it. Disagree, but commit. Yeah.
That's the phrase. Yeah. Love it, man. So let's go into this. Hiring the CEO seems like a huge part of your process, obviously. Like in any business, hiring people is maybe the most important part, or one of the top three anyway, alongside having a great product in the first place, and then marketing it and getting out there. So I've heard you talk about the four types of entrepreneurs, but you talked about innovators, remixers, scalers, and optimizers. I think I know which one you are, but would you be able to just explain like what those four are?
Yeah. So I used the example of Chipotle. So there's the guy who created the burrito in the first place. There's the founder of Chipotle who said, wow, burritos are great food. They'd make good fast food and made the first couple locations. Then there's the person who took Chipotle from 3 locations to 100 locations. And then finally, there's the person who just oversaw it once it was at scale. And I think each of those is a different personality type. And one of the problems, very few CEOs can go from innovator and starter all the way to maintainer. I just don't think that's feasible. There's a few people who can pull it off, like Mark Zuckerberg or Steve Jobs or some of these people, but really most CEOs should, I think, or most founders should hand the reins to somebody who is better at that particular junction. It's been a kind of a neat insight. Yeah.
And just to clarify, out of those four, innovators, remixers, scalers, and optimizers, which one would you say you are primarily?
I think I'm a scaler and a remixer, probably. I can do a bit of both. I think like my job these days is really just to look at all the potential ways to grow a business and then decide which particular levers we should pull when we buy a business.
Well, I'm curious, like when you were younger and you might have been this crazy ambitious kid who says, I'm turning up in Silicon Valley and I've got Pinterest and Apple paying me money. A lot of people at that stage of their entrepreneurial career think they're all four of those, or they haven't even heard the phrases, right? I'm wondering if you ever felt like that, and were there certain realizations or questions you asked yourself to say, okay, maybe I'm not great at these sorts of things? Because I feel like a lot of people don't have the self-awareness to know, or the humility to say, actually, I'm really not good at follow through, or I'll get better at that one day, or something like that.
I mean, I just kept trying it and failing over and over again. It didn't matter how many management books I read or what KPI or 360 system I used. I just could never be a good CEO when it came to day-to-day operations. I could be a good CEO in terms of strategy and vision, but I hated the follow through and I was too distractible. I needed more things to look at and more diversity. So doing Tiny, I can jump around and always have something new to look at, or I can focus on the businesses I'm finding interesting at that moment. But when I move away, I'm not letting down the business, right? There's CEOs that are following through on everything. So that just works so much better for me.
So when you're hiring a CEO, let's get into that process a little bit. So I'm assuming the CEO you're trying to hire is that fourth bucket, which is optimizers and scalers, probably like the last two, because the innovators, remixers are normally like 0 to 1, and now you're going from 1 to X. So, first of all, is that accurate before I assume?
Yeah, totally.
Okay, got it. So with the CEOs you're hiring, it sounds like you've got this process down right now. But it sounds way too easy. And I'm sure, especially in the beginning, it's not easy at all. So like, what are the sorts of things that you're looking out for that make one a competent CEO, but also someone who's going to stay motivated and doesn't kind of outgrow that role too quickly or want to go and leave and do their own thing? I'm curious how you think about that.
Well, I look for people who want the job you're offering, right? I've made this mistake before where you're hiring someone to do HR and they say, well, my dream is to get into design, right? Or whatever it is. And so what I really want is somebody who has done the thing that I'm hiring them to do before. So if I buy a marketplace business in the design space, I want to find someone who's run or been a top executive at a large design marketplace business that's been successful. And I want to take them back and say, look, you scaled that up to 100 million. Come back and take this one that's at 20 and scale it to 100 million. And I always like to joke that, like, you want to find the person. If you're going to build a house, you're not going to go and find some neighborhood kid who's, really excited about learning how to build stuff. You're going to find the super experienced general contractor who's done it 100 times. We take the same approach. So we really look for people who have done this exact thing before, and they're hungry. They want to succeed, and we can align them with us so that if we do well, they'll do well too.
To play devil's advocate, there's also people though that have done this before and then they want to move on to the next big thing, right? So I guess this, you have to package it up as the next big thing for them, and it kind of brings us on to incentives, right? So like, if I've already done this before, I'm probably already wealthy enough that I'm not doing it primarily for the
job.
You'd
be surprised. I mean, a lot of the time it's someone who's been a number two or a number three, or they've done it for a private equity firm and they had a small amount of stock options or something, but they're not making, tens of millions of dollars necessarily. So, we can come in and say, hey, get in at the ground floor. this is a huge opportunity. And hey, you were a VP before, now you're a CEO. And I think people get really excited about that. And it doesn't mean that we have to stop when we get to 100 million. We can keep going. You know, we can take the company public, or we can get it to 300 million. I mean, there's no rule about, you know, it being capped.
So just to get a little tactical, like, what does that process look like for you? Is that you working with a recruiter? Is it you just going out to your network and saying, like, I'm hiring a CEO for this sort of company? Like, where do, if you were doing an 80-20 analysis of where people have come, the best people have come from, like, where have they come from for you guys?
Well, I used to be totally opposed to recruiters. And I would just go on LinkedIn and kind of do that. I still do that, but I've found that hiring really, really good recruiters is worth the money just to have somebody to delegate the task to say, like, look, go out, go as wide as you can, get me in front of as many people as possible. And then from there, you know, it's a lot of talking to people, and there's often people who are very competent, but who I just don't enjoy talking to. They just don't feel right culturally, or I don't kind of get a good vibe from them. And then once we're ready to hire someone, we do a lot of background checking. So we call all the people they've worked with before. We check, you know, all their references, everything they've told us, to make sure that there's no, you know, no shadiness or anything like that. And, you know, that process has served us very well. We have an incredible group of CEOs, and, you know, I'd happily get stuck in an elevator with any of them.
Have you had to fire any of your CEOs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you get to our size, you know, it's really unfortunate, but you know, every year or two, often we have to make changes at certain businesses, or people naturally leave over time, or want to move on to the next thing, or, you know, whatever it is. That's probably the hardest part about my job.
Yeah, that's tough. If you don't mind me asking, like, what does that conversation look like with having to fire someone? Like,
I mean, the big thing is, unless somebody has done something unethical, I always think of having to part ways with somebody as, you know, hey, it's just not working out. And if you are in a romantic relationship, there's nothing crueler than leading someone on and staying in the relationship with them when it's just not working. So I'm a big fan of just being very candid and saying that, you know, look, this isn't working out. It's just not a fit anymore. And we try and be just hyper empathetic. We make sure that we give people a very soft landing, try and give as much severance as we can. And, you know, if someone's great, often it just means sometimes the business has gotten to a scale where it may have outgrown them, or there's a different skill set needed, or whatever. So we're always as soft as we can be with that stuff, and try and make it a good soft landing for them. But it's never easy.
I've heard you talk a lot about CEOs, but not that much about other roles within a company. So first of all, I guess a qualifying question is, are you responsible for helping to hire the head of HR, CMO, et cetera? That's all down to the CEO.
We always say hire one to hire 10. So, you know, yeah, for example, like, you know, if we acquire a business and we acquire it in January, we're not able to recruit a CEO until March. We're better off spending 3 months focusing on getting that CEO than trying to hire a VP of sales, VP of marketing, et cetera, because that CEO will be able to go hire those people. So we try and make one decision, which is the CEO. And we often get ourselves into trouble by starting to do too much other stuff.
You've really got the delegation down, man. So this brings us on to incentives, which I mentioned before, but this was one of my favorite Charlie Munger quotes. I've heard him talk about, show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. I don't know if that's actually him or someone else, but I think that's a really succinct way of putting it. But I also love this other one, which is, the iron rule of nature is you get what you reward for. If you want ants to come, you put sugar on the floor. And I love that one because it's just this visual of ants coming on the floor. But it's really just, it seems so obvious again, but getting the right incentives is really difficult. Like, especially for, you know, if you're a smaller company and you're trying to hire someone who might have already done this before, I'm curious, like, how you've kind of learned over time to have better incentives. And were there certain things you thought previously that were really important that no longer are?
Well, I'm a big fan of not incentivizing people who are not driving a specific result where it's measurable with a number. So for example, if someone's creative, if they're a designer, I just want to pay them what they think they're worth, right? Whatever a fair salary is, you know, we might give them gifts, we might give them a random bonus here and there. But at the end of the day, I want a creative person just being creative, not going, you know, oh, if I bill this many hours and deliver this one on time, I'm getting a bonus. So generally, when it comes to creative roles or engineering roles, we try and keep them super focused on the task at hand and just pay them. When it comes to sales or marketing, where they can drive measurable results, we try and really, really incentivize them exclusively around the result that they deliver. Mm. So for example, if we had somebody doing sales, we would basically say, okay, you have a target, and if you hit within 70% of your target, you're going to trigger your bonus. And if you do 200 times the target, you get 200% bonus or whatever it is. That's worked very, very well for us. And it's shocked us how much incentives do drive behavior. But you do have to be careful not to over incentivize, because then you can create aggressive behavior that's unsustainable, where you have a salesperson who's just trying to hit a target, and so they end up signing a bunch of bad work or bad clients or, you know, whatever it is. So there's a delicate balance for sure. And creating true alignment is also difficult, right? Other than someone who's bought into the business, right? When you have someone who's bought into the business and bought equity, I think that's the best alignment. And just figuring out how to create that with employees is very difficult.
From my experience, I've found that, like, in the past, I've worked a lot with retailers, right, or e-commerce businesses, and a lot of the traditional ones had their stores they cared about. Let's just say Macy's. Macy's has all their stores, well, their stores where people are going to buy, and then they've got their online division. And early on, as you would have experienced in the early 2000s, a lot of those web teams were just like, first of all, the IT person, first of all, and then eventually it became the e-commerce team. But they were so small, it was like 1 or 5% of revenue, that there just wasn't any cohesion between them. And I think even in 2021, that's still an issue, like from the people I've worked with. And I've literally been in meetings where I'll speak to the head of e-commerce and I'll speak to the head of brand. And then there's a person who's responsible for retail, and they will literally say, well, we're not going to do that because it's not going to drive my number. And they're in front of the other person, right? And it's totally just this fight and politics. So yeah. And is there an antidote to that apart from having equity?
I mean, what we do is we just generally incentivize around net profit, which is the most alignment with shareholders. So you say, okay, so a dollar of net profit to shareholders is a good measure of whether they've been able to sell. This doesn't work in every single business, but let's say for a salesperson in an agency, for example, if we have a net profit target for the quarter, they know that if they close a whole bunch of deals, they're going to be, and we have a good margin on that, they're going to hit that net profit target. And so if you have client services, you know, client partners, account management and stuff incentivized for that number, you have your sales team incentivized that number, everyone's winning together and everyone wants the same number. I think it's much harder when you're in a big hulking corporation where everyone kind of controls something different and you're synergized, so you rely on the other parties. That's where it gets really, really hard.
I think the net profit aligns to you guys as well as the parent, because that's what you're optimizing for. I think it becomes harder, as you said, like when I worked at Google for a long time, and in that organization, to put it bluntly, there was one, this was in the sales team, right? So there's account management sales, new business sales, etc. And sometimes within the account management sales, there was a time where you were incentivizing employees to just make lots of phone calls. Right, and you probably notice if you've ever run Google ads, there's people calling you, or Facebook ads. And that was the wrong incentive, right? Because people would fake the calls. They would just like make 100 calls, but none of them are translating into anything. Mm-hmm. And I guess as you grow, that becomes a lot harder to do. Have you run into any issues like that as well as with your biggest companies?
No, I mean, we've really kept the incentives really simple. And for the most part, they've worked. The hard part has been for us when the worst part has been in some of the businesses, we did this thing where we said, you get paid your bonus for hitting a target, and the target is based on the budget. And then what ends up happening is we're looking at the budget and going, you know, hey, look, you've grown 30% for the last 3 years. Next year, the budget should be at 30% higher, But because they're incentivized on a target based on the budget, they're fighting us and saying, oh, no, this year is going to be horrible. We're only going to grow 5%. And so we end up having to fight with them. So what we've shifted to in most of the businesses is just saying every year the hurdle increases by 20%. And as long as you grow 20%, everyone's hitting 100% of their bonuses. Obviously, for extenuating circumstances, difficult years, we'll tweak that and stuff. But that's one of those unintended second order consequences where we're going, God, why are they so conservative in their budgeting? And then we finally realize.
So just the last point on that is around delegation. So I think I've seen you share an example of how you had an idea for an email service and you basically found someone and you maybe put in a few hours of work and that person basically did everything else. Would you mind sharing that example? Because I think it was one of the best examples of how simple and effective your style was.
So there's two good examples of that. One was I was playing tennis with a friend and he brought along another friend of his and he goes, oh, you know, meet Christian. He's a great furniture designer. Him and I are thinking about trying to sell it online. And I went, oh my God, I looked up his furniture. I was like, dude, your furniture is amazing. Let's start a business. And so I brought one of my agencies in to build the e-commerce side of it. I funded, all the development and kind of starting the company or whatever. And then we structured it. And, my friend ran it as CEO. And then the furniture designer, Christian, did all the design and they produced the furniture and we did the e-commerce and fulfillment. And suddenly we have a business. And, I think it cost us 50 grand or 25 grand or something to start. The other one was I was drowning in email. And I had this idea. I just said, I want my email inbox to be like Don Draper's. I just want the mailman to come twice a day, right? And so I tweeted that out. I said, look, are there any engineers out there that could build this for me? And this guy, Mohit from India, messaged me and said, hey, I'd love to partner with you on this. We started building it. He was so awesome and just such a great, clearly a great business partner, great guy, great engineer and designer. That we just, I said, look, like, let's do this together and partner on this. And I probably spent 5 to 10 hours giving feedback and using it and everything. But at the end of the day, there's another business that I owned a big chunk of.
Do you mind me asking, and whatever you're happy to share, but like in a partnership like that, how does an equity split look like when you're partnering with someone, you came up with the idea, you're funding it, you've already got an audience that you've built up over years as well, which I think is quite a big part of it. If you wouldn't mind me asking, like, how do you think about an equity split with someone in that situation?
Well, to me, it comes down to how much risk they're willing to take. Are they willing to not take a salary? Are they willing to put their own money into it? And whether or not they're willing to do that is going to dictate the amount of equity. I can't disclose the exact percentages or anything, but in that instance, what we negotiated was he was going to get a really good salary and I was going to fund all the ad spend. I was going to pay for my agency to design it. We're going to find an ad agency to rep us. So, I think I ended up in a majority position in that one. But it just depends if someone came, if he came along and he said, look, you put in 200, I'll put in 200. It'd be 50-50 probably, right?
I've heard you talk about other opportunities of companies that you didn't buy or you considered, like meetup.com, I heard you talk about. And I saw you tweet that on Twitter, you said Twitter should be milking money. They're so under-optimized. I'm curious with those two examples or any others that come to mind. Like let's say Twitter, for example. Why do you think they should be milking money and they're not doing it? Like, what would you do if you were the head of Twitter?
What we've learned with Dribbble is that when you have a super engaged audience, it's a little bit like owning the airport. And what I mean by that is in the airport, there's one airport per city or maybe a couple. And if you want to fly, you've got to go there. And if you want to fly, you have to sit there for an hour and wait for your plane. Well, when you're sitting there in the lobby or in the gate or whatever, there's a whole bunch of stalls for different businesses. So you have this captive market that you can sell things to. And so if you think about Dribbble, for example, as an airport, well, there's a whole bunch of designers congregated there. They might want to have some coffee. They might want to get a massage. They might want to have go to the restaurant. They might want to buy a book for their flight, etc. And I think that a social network is no different. So we're just going, okay, well, these designers want to promote their work. Advertisers want to advertise to them. Maybe they want to sell their digital goods. Like, there's just endless numbers of things you can do with that. And so with Dribbble, where I think they're falling down is, yes, they've done the social network and advertising, but I do think there's all sorts of kind of SaaS business models you could start applying to it, where as a Twitter user, like as someone who's an influencer, I would pay a lot of money to be able to have deep analytics, to be able to know, you know, which tweets are really working, which are driving negative sentiment, to be able to prioritize certain ones, different media types, scheduling posts. I mean, there's endless numbers of things like that. I think the biggest thing with Twitter, though, is just that they're based in San Francisco and they're paying these crazy high salaries. And I think that what's going to be really interesting over the next 10 years is that now that everyone's realized you can work remotely, I think those jobs are going to be globalized. I think they're going to go all over the world. And I think that these businesses are going to be much more profitable and efficient because of that. And I'm not talking about outsourcing even. I'm just saying, let's go to middle America and employ a bunch of people there who'd be grateful to have the job instead of a bunch of spoiled rich people in San Francisco.
Like, I, as someone who like has run ads for a long time as well, to me, Twitter should be the best. It should be up there as the best platform anyway, because the data they have, everything's open.
Well, and you should be able to say, I want to get on this person's radar, right? If exactly. Let's say I work at Oracle and I'm trying to close somebody, a Walmart executive on using Oracle database or whatever. I want to be able to say, I want to influence that person and everyone on their team, and I want them to nonstop see Oracle stuff, right? There's interesting things like that where these high value contracts and opportunities where there's just not enough granularity. Now that may be a privacy thing or something like that, but I think there's tons of stuff like that that's super interesting.
Last thing, just to wrap us up here, I know that you have printed out annual shareholder letters in the past, and you spend like a whole Sunday just reading from start to end, apparently. I haven't really heard you speak much about like some of your favorite ones that maybe people could check out, or anything you've like learned from them that is actually applicable to today's businesses that you run.
I mean, the most interesting ones I've read recently are Constellation Software. And then the other one I also read last week was Fairfax Financial. And what's really cool to me is seeing these businesses when they were tiny, right? When they're really, really small. I mean, the Fairfax letters, I think in the first one, they have $2 or $3 million of net profit. And that's a business now that I think throws off billions of dollars of profits. And seeing that, you know, with the power of compounding, over the course of 20 or 30 years, you can go from a business that's teeny tiny to a multi-billion dollar behemoth. And just seeing the kind of methodical decision-making happen year by year by year or quarter by quarter. I remember 10 years ago, I sat down and said, okay, I have about this much money. My businesses make about this much profit. You know, if I compound it by 15 years for 10 years, what's that number going to be? And I remember this number spat out with all these zeros, and I went, oh my God, I must have calculated this wrong. There's no way this is right. Like, that's ridiculous. I'm never going to be able to do that. Well, we exceeded that number in a short period of time because of compounding. And this is the thing about compounding, is it happens slowly until one day it doesn't. All of a sudden you look down and you're sitting on a mountain and you're like, how did this happen? And it's just slow, methodical work over the course of years. So it's been really crazy to watch that. And I think that it's important to take a long-term view. And that's what I think reading these shareholder letters drives home. These things are built over 20 or 30 years. They're not overnight successes.
I love that, man. Yeah, the compounding thing definitely catches up. And I haven't experienced it at the same scale, obviously, but just like when you use those calculators that show you, if you invest your money in the market and it grows at 8%, you're like, wow, that's kind of crazy. The last question to wrap up is, you're seeing so many businesses out there and so many different worlds. Are there a few areas you're most excited by? You mentioned e-commerce there. I've heard you talk about no code, and you've been, even in the philanthropic side, you've been funding some science stuff with people like Dr. Peter Attia and Rhonda Patrick. I'm curious, like, as someone who's interested in so many things. Like, what are the most exciting things out there for you?
Well, I mean, I'm having the most fun doing local news. So I started as a journalism student. That's where I went to university and did a journalism degree, but I dropped out. But I've always been a big fan of journalism and news and an avid reader of the newspaper. And about, I don't know, 2-3 years ago, I kept picking up our local paper and just being totally dejected. They just weren't really hiring anyone new. They had fired their entire staff, basically. And it was just a bunch of wire service news articles. And I just went, man, if no one's writing about what's happening in the city, how is anyone supposed to be engaged politically or push for changes, you know, in the city? And so, you know, I went, okay, well, how could we solve this? Let's do a daily newsletter and just hire a journalist. And the one journalist will just kind of say, here's what's going on in the city today. And we started that. And now we have 42,000 daily subscribers in a city of 250,000. So we have a lot of the, you know,
that's
citizens
crazy.
Reading it, which is cool. And we're expanding that right now. I've just hired a CEO and a new editor in chief. And I'm just having a blast. I don't know if it's a big moneymaker, but it's a big passion project for me.
Well, listen, man, thanks so much for spending so much time. I know it's a crazy week for you. I'd love to do this again. And is there anywhere we can send people who are listening to this?
Yeah, I mean, if someone's interested in seeing what we do, they can go to tinycapital.com or best place to follow me is on Twitter. My Twitter is A. Wilkinson.
Awesome. We'll put that on the screen for people on YouTube as well. And listen, man, keep doing what you're doing. You're crushing it. And I know you guys are going to keep leading the way in this space. So thanks for coming on the show.
You bet. That was really fun. Thanks a lot.
I hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. I'll have an episode for you every week. These are raw, uncut, and actionable conversations with the greatest business minds and creators in the world. So make sure you're subscribed. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, B-Z-A-I-D-I, or CreatorLabFM on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.